Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
John Golub joins us now in our Bloomberg 1130 studios here in New York. Jonathan Golub, the chief U.S. market strategist at RBC Capital Markets. We were just reminiscing about the evening of November 8th. You were here as we went through the results that evening. What's your sense of what's happened since, market-wise? There was this swoon. There was this great enthusiasm in the markets afterward. Help us understand what's been through the going through the undulations here leading up to today.
Well, you mean, I think there's two stories. The first thing is there was this natural knee-jerk reaction to Trump, but then I think the market realized that these pro-growth policies may actually may be much more important or positive than people think. But what really has happened over the last 4 months is that the economy has been really good. Expectations for corporate profits have been good. If you look at market returns, the day before the election, when people thought Hillary was going to win, the market was up, and then after, the market was still up. So it appears the real story here is this is way less about Donald Trump and really more about an improving global economy and U.S. economy.
And the reflation trade, you've helped us with the definition of that in your most recent note. You note that there are so many definitions spinning around. How do you define those reflationary pressures?
Yeah, we've been in this ultra-low inflation, ultra-low interest rate environment, and it's been really damaging. And it's been damaging, for example, to people who are in retirement or planning for retirement, and it causes them to do something really interesting, which is to save even more money because they can't get any kind of return on their assets. While you would think that corporations would take advantage of these low interest rates, they look at it as a sign of the world being broken, and they do the opposite. They actually refuse to invest. And so there's actually a fair bit of damage done by this kind of environment. So reflating and getting back to something which looks more normal, where you can actually get a return on your bank, on a savings account, that's actually a really positive thing and maybe the big surprise over the next year or two if rates can get back towards something that feels a bit more normal.
Was there a Trump trade? As you look back at it now, was there a Trump trade? If there was one, when did it lose its luster for you?
I think that there was probably a Trump trade for about a week. Mm-hmm. If you look, the market had this vicious sell-off and stopped out really overnight. And then it bounced really hard. But for the last 3.5 months, most of this has just been economics. And we can see that by the kinds of companies that are driving the market.
John, it's great to have David Gura back with us. He took his family to Antarctica. And we got an email. He was like in Terra del Fuego.
Yeah,
and he got up to Buenos Aires for the flight back. And it's long. With that, help us here with the idea of foreign investment right now. If I want to invest, seriously, not in Antarctica, but in Argentina. How do I express it now? Do I do it through U.S. multinationals or do I buy abroad?
There's a big difference between the companies that you would invest in the U.S. compared to overseas. Non-U.S. portfolios tend to have a ton of banks and old economy. And in the U.S., if you think about innovative tech companies and biotech companies, so the U.S. kind of feels more like the NASDAQ is a bit fresher. The interesting thing, though, is if the economy is bouncing, old economy, these old banks and old industry tends to actually bounce harder, which could surprisingly be good for some of these non-U.S. investments.
What's been going on with emerging markets? A surprising result since the election, you've noted.
Yeah, versus the gloom.
Yeah, if you look at kind of the orthodoxy, and the data proves this to be the case, is when the dollar is strengthening, you don't want to be in emerging markets, and emerging markets have been on fire. It's really about a re-risking. I mean, what do you have right now is small caps are beating the markets. Riskier assets are beating the markets. Companies that are more volatile and less stable and less dependable earnings are beating the markets. And that environment has just been great for emerging market companies, and it really has been the big surprise over the last 3 or 4 months.
I was talking with our colleague Oliver Rennick, and he said that small caps is really where it's at this point. What's your advice on how to approach that space right now, if we're seeing that looked upon so favorably?
Right, well, if you said what are the real big wins, and all of them I think are going to continue. First of all, just betting on the banks as a win has been, if you did that, nothing else, you've done unbelievably well. I think that continues to ride. Value stocks, cheap companies have outperformed the market, and then smaller companies. But the smaller company thing is really about risk. It's the fact that they are riskier, more volatile, and that's what's really been driving it, not the fact that they're small.
How do I catch up? I heard this.
He didn't buy the banks.
I didn't hear this 18 times this weekend, but I'm sorry, folks. I heard it like 6 times. The percentage of the institutional and retail public that hasn't made the bogey is, I've never seen it. It's off the chart. Do you catch up with use of leverage? Do you catch up with going sexier, fancier, higher beta, to use a Greek letter? Folks, we have to use a Greek letter
every
after
day.
That.
Yeah.
Oscars screwed up last night. I mean, they needed beta last night at the end of the Oscars. Help me. Actually, they needed a stiff drink. Yeah. Help me here with how I catch up.
Yeah, you know, Tom, I don't think you want to invest thinking about how you catch up
for
what you haven't done. So what you want to do is just, you know, if you think that this thing has legs, I think that you want to get in it and really what's been working the last few months, it's value companies, it's companies that are a little bit riskier, it's banks, it's cyclicals.
The arch idea here, and please, you're the pro, I'm not. You jump into the market knowing you could enjoy a bear market of X percent down, and you still got to get the market psychologically ready to take that hit if it comes. Yeah. And we've all gotten spoiled.
Forget about whether you have a pullback of 2% or 5% or something like that, which is normal and natural.
18% bear market.
But if you were talking about really big, you know, 15, 20% kind of pullbacks, they almost only occur when you have recessions. And there's just none of the indications that a recession is around the corner are in place. So the likelihood of having that walloping pullback is just extremely low right now. You'd have to have something really go badly. And right now, from an economic and markets perspective, it doesn't appear to be there.
Could we be missing something? We talk about orthodoxy and how emerging markets should be performing with the dollar where it's at. Could we be missing something when it comes to forecasting for a recession at this point?
If there can clearly be policy issues, and you know, if you have these border adjusted tax issues, or if we end up in a trade war, or if there's some type of a geopolitical event, they could be really disruptive. And the market's struggling with how to handicap that. But if you look even at the volatility in the market's telling you that it thinks the likelihood of those things is reasonably low. So yeah, we could always be missing something. But the yield curve, the difference between a long-dated bond and something that's near, short-dated, it's steep. That's a sign that you're not likely to have a recession. The employment market, we're creating lots of jobs. That's not something you have as you're moving towards a recession. Wages are rising steadily. That's not something that you have. Housing activity. You know, if you made a list of the dozen things you want to see to tell you that recessions aren't around the corner, 10 of the 12 are telling you, or 12 of the 12 are telling you that everything's fine.
Yeah. You and I mentioned the banks earlier. You said be in the banks if you believe in higher rates. What about the industrials? The president likes to trot these people out at a photo fest at the White House. Are they happy? I mean, Emerson Electric, the CEO, shows up. Are the Emerson Electrics of the world happy?
I think it's a much murkier picture.
The GDP ain't there.
Well, but if you think about it, if you're a company, one of the things you want to know is where you're going to get your supplies from. And if you don't know what the border adjusted taxes or trade issues are going to be, if you're Ford and you don't know whether you're making cars in Mexico or the United States, it affects decisions and it's hard to make those.
I'm glad you mentioned this. We're going to come back with John Golub. Here's what I'm going to do, folks. Because, my theme this weekend, besides I miss David Gurr so much, and like Antarctica with the kids. Are you kidding me? A sheet of ice is going to fall into the ocean. Anyways, I said, besides missing David Gurr, I said, I got to read about the border tax. I'm going to put out on Twitter 2 killer articles on the border tax that I looked at this weekend. We're going to rip up the script big time right now. Greg Villiers just wrote a blistering note on Republican realities, speaking about an epic war to come in the budget battle. He takes it back, John Golub, to the Budget Control Act of 2011, which sets sequester caps and, you know, all the rest of it. What happens to your world? And forget about the politics of this, folks, pro-Trump, anti-Trump. If we just get delay, if the X-axis extends out, where what we thought would happen in April happens in November, where we thought what would happen in November is pushed into the next year, if 2018 is pushed to 2020, how does your world respond to that?
Well, first of all, I think that's exactly what's going to happen. I mean, you saw this with Mnuchin, who talked about hoping to get something on taxes by August, which probably means that getting something on taxes is a 2018 event. As long as we are confident that there's something which looks like pro-growth somewhere in the attainable future, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months out, I think the market stays perfectly engaged. What we don't want to see is the process break down in front of us to believe that it can't happen. As long as we have that promise, a year from now, 6 months from now, all the same.
I look at the Bloomberg, I pick up the FT, I see a lot of articles about how investors are very hungry for detail in the speech tomorrow night, and you look back at history. State of the Union addresses, joint addresses to joint sessions of Congress are usually short on details. They're full of sweeping statements, and seems like from Greg Valliere's note that Tom just mentioned, we're going to get a big sweeping rhetorical speech tomorrow night. How important are the details to you? How important is it that there be details in that speech tomorrow night?
Okay, so the details are really important,
yeah.
And I have zero expectations. I mean, you're talking about, David, that a president other than Donald Trump has been short on giving details. What's the incentive for Donald Trump to give details at this very moment in time?
David, continue here, but I just had an incredible insight went through my Monday morning brain. Forget about fake news. What if he started going on fake strategy? You know, guys like John, fake strategy from John Golub. I mean, that could be the next frontier for Bloomberg surveillance.
Well, we can debate the fakeness of it, but listening to the Sunday shows yesterday on Bloomberg Radio yesterday afternoon, there were a lot of conversations about here we are a few weeks into the first 100 days, so there's still time to go. But we haven't seen great movement in the House or Senate when it comes to repealing the Affordable Care Act. We haven't seen a lot when it comes to tax reform. How worried about that are you, that the great strategic promise there was a lot of this stuff would happen early?
From a market's perspective, what's most important is that he give priority to the things that the market cares about most. And so the market doesn't care about immigration issues. The market cares really about two things.
It doesn't care about the New York Times.
Yeah, either. And the market doesn't care about but the latest tweet or whether he shows up to to a press event. What the market cares about is, are we going to see something on taxes? And frankly, if it happens at the beginning of 18 instead of the middle of 17, as long as we believe that directionally it's moving, I think the market's going to be comfortable with that. And the market wants to see, a pullback in regulation. And all these things, taxes is really hard. But on the regulatory front, there's a lot that it can do through executive order. There is areas such as financial regulation, where both Democrats and Republicans believe that there are areas within Dodd-Frank that can be improved upon. So even a modest softening of things like that would really be quite appealing. What the market doesn't want to see is an obsession on things that don't matter to the economy.
As an investor, am I happy that executives from big companies are now interfacing with the president in a new way, that they're being called to the portico, that they're being called to the cabinet room to meet with the president, to have these listening sessions? Is that a good thing, that new kind of dynamic?
You know, as I'm talking to institutional investors, they're frankly not spending as much time worrying about the latest photo op. What they're obsessing on, which they're not getting to your point, is they want to see the actual details around this tax plan more than anything else. And to the extent that they can get that on some regulatory issues as well, great. But it appears as if this stuff is going to be take a little time. And I think Mnuchin did a brilliant job of putting August out there by basically saying I'm promising you something's on the come. Mm-hmm. Just be patient with me. And I think that was a really smart move.
You must be happy now to see Steven Mnuchin in that job, to see Rex Tillerson confirmed in that job. It must provide some stability for the market to have the heads of those agencies in place.
Yeah, and I think that there's a wide belief that whether you agree with their politics or this or that, that they're grown-ups in the seats, they're reasonable guys. If you look at the when Tillerson was speaking to foreign leaders, or when the vice president is speaking to foreign leaders, they're speaking with a tone which is, I think, pretty familiar. Comfortable for people. Yeah.
Lincoln, we're going to run out of time here. Lincoln, here in 30 seconds, your view with Tom Porcelli's view. Are we going to get the GDP the president needs to make America great again? Let's call it 3.0%.
Yeah, we have a shot at something between 2.5% and 3% this year. But I think that what you're going to get is nominal GDP will be substantially higher. That's GDP plus inflation.
Yeah, what's that do to real? Oh, we can't talk real wages. You got to come back, and we got to talk about real
wages.
Well, wages
will be
well.
Up. That's what people will focus on.
Okay, John Golub, RBC Capital Markets. Thank you for the time commitment. This Monday morning, David Gurin, Tom Keene, worldwide, coast to coast, this is Bloomberg. David, I want you to bring in the next guest here as we talk about policy and the abstract issues of medicine. But I just want to say, David, that every parent has tattooed to their brain the once a year, the once every 3 years, where you go. Where you go where I live is 525 East 68th Street.
Uh-huh.
That's where you go when you need – there's that moment where you need to go with said child, and it's 525 East 68th Street, New York, New York.
A man very familiar with that address is Dr. Steve Corwin. He's the president and CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital, joining us here in our studios in New York as the president prepares to meet with health insurance company CEOs. He's calling it a listening session today. He's had a few of these. Were you around the table there? What would you say to him about what needs to happen to the Affordable Care Act, whether it's repeal, replace, repair? What does the government need to do here to right the ship?
Well, I think repeal is an overreach. I think that the Medicaid expansion has worked. I think a number of Republican governors have told the president that. I think the Medicaid expansion should continue and not be rolled back. The individual insurance market needs to be repaired. We have many areas in the country where there's only a single insurer. People are concerned about deductibles and premiums. But that individual insurance market cannot work in the absence, in my opinion, of an individual mandate and subsidies for the insurance companies. And I think the health insurance executives will tell the president that today.
You've got a company like Aetna pulling out of a number of these markets, saying they're not eager to get back into them at this point in time. What's it going to take these insurers to get back into markets that they've left?
Well, I think first there needs to be stability. You need to tell people this is where we're going. I think it would be very unfortunate if, with the House Republican reconciliation bill, the individual mandate and the subsidies were removed, because that will just precipitate this happening.
Doctor, you're out of Northwestern and then Columbia P&S, and you've got this blending of being a practicing cardiologist with the actual running of a hospital. What do doctors and nurses want or think of this silly debate in Washington? Basically, we have non-experts experting on the fact that if David Gurra's kids or my kids are sick, we need them fixed by the best talent we can find. How do you people respond to this debate in Washington?
We have over 30,000 employees, and I would tell you that their response to this is, when somebody's sick, you've got to take care of them. One out of every four people in New York State is on Medicaid. One out of every three New York City residents is on Medicaid. And this is replicated throughout the country. I think it's important to recognize that Medicaid insures over 75 million Americans. And you have to have insurance in this country. Access to care is not insurance.
Okay. One of the great things is that Logan and Boston, or there's many other cities here at JFK, foreign people come here when they're really sick. I've seen it. They come through our airports, whether it's Cleveland Clinic or MGH or your wonderful hospital. How do we repair and move forward away from 16% of GDP or whatever we're spending to the proper balance of medicine?
I think in order to bend the cost curve, you've got to deal more with preventive health, mental health. I know this is unpopular in many areas, but I am in favor of a tax on sugary drinks. You've seen in Mexico the reduction in soda consumption. If you can't prevent illness, you're going to have substantial expenses associated with caring for people. And I think that that is one of the things that should be kept with the Affordable Care Act.
Just about 30 seconds left, too short. I'm sorry to say, but are you convinced this is going to be a more participatory process going forward? A lot of people have complained that when the Affordable Care Act came about, all the parties weren't involved in crafting it that needed to be. When it comes to changing the law, do you think more voices are going to be heard? There are going to be more voices at the table.
I would hope that we could get bipartisan support on that. Right now, it looks like it is just going to be one party doing it, and I think that would be unfortunate.
Do I have to walk 10,000 steps a day?
I'd like for you to do that.
Go away, really. The tall 10,000 step things you think is an adequate measure of good health, a path to good health.
Exercise is great for the brain, great for the heart, and I would urge everybody to exercise.
You are so done. Thank you. Dr. Corwin, thank you
great
so
to
much.
Have you. Thank
with
you
New York Presbyterian, please come by in a weekly. Oh, I just got a message here from Mrs. Keene. Have Dr. Corwin daily. Okay. Thank you. David Gura, Tom Keene. This is Bloomberg. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. David Gura, this is very, very smart work on our foreign policy and the choices in the debates the new administration has to do. I like Trump's team of rivals. It's very Lincoln-esque.
Thomas Wright is on the line, director of the Project on International Order and Strategy at the Brookings Institution, co-author of a new report, Building Situations of Strength, a National Security Strategy for the United States. And Thomas Wright, let me ask you, first of all, about this president's national security strategy. How different is it now that Michael Flynn, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, is out of office? He's no longer the National Security Advisor. Did we see Donald Trump's foreign policy change?
I think it's highly significant, actually. It's one of the most significant developments in his first month in office. Not typically in the way people think, though. I think what's striking to me is that this basically denies President Trump and Steve Bannon sort of access and control of the bureaucracy to forward an America First agenda. So, you know, to the extent that they have very radical ideas about American foreign policy, it is much harder now for them to use the interagency process and sort of the White House infrastructure to push that throughout the different departments in a way they might have been able to do so with Flynn. So, you know, President Trump still has his views, Bannon still has his views, they'll do their thing. But there's a bit more of a constraint there from the NSC than there was a few weeks ago.
What's your sense of who is crafting and guiding foreign policy in this White House? Is it H.R. McMaster, Michael Flynn's successor? Is it James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State? Or is it the president himself?
I think there's no easy answer to that because there is a structural incoherence sort of built into this administration. Like there's no there's no sort of unified position, and there will not be one because the views of the president and of Bannon and maybe of a few others around him are so fundamentally different than those of the cabinet. So what we're likely to see is a continuing sort of struggle and wrestling match to see who comes out on top on different issues. But those looking for sort of the voice of coherence or who can sort of sum it all up, I think they'll be looking for a long time, because that's not going to happen, I think, in a Trump administration.
We were talking to Jonathan Golub with RBC Capital Markets, and he spoke about how he's listening to what the vice president has to say when he's traveling abroad. He's listening to the Secretary of State when he goes to Europe and talks to our allies there. How much discord or dissonance is there between the message we're hearing from those underneath Donald Trump and the messages that we're hearing from the president himself?
Well, there's enormous difference. The vice president's comments in Munich are a great example. Like he went there and gave a speech that George W. Bush could have given. So that is reassuring to a lot of people who want to see a strong sort of U.S. alliance in Europe. But the fact of the matter is that if there's a crisis, say there's a crisis with Russia in the Baltics or somewhere else, the person who gets to make the decision about what to do is the president, right? So I certainly understand those who point to Tillerson and Pence and Madison and say, oh, you should just listen to them. That's really what's important. But at the end of the day, you know, Trump is going to have a major say, and his personal views could determine whether or not the U.S. upholds some of these commitments or not. So I'm not fully reassured. I think it's a positive thing that they're saying the things they're saying, and I'm glad they're doing it when they go to when Madison, Tillerson, and Pence go to these places, but it's not sufficient.
Okay, enough of the Brookings 35,000 feet stuff. Dr. Wright, tomorrow night, if the president possibly goes off speech script, and let's say he goes after fake news, et cetera, all the other themes of the moment, if he starts bashing Name the Nation or, you know, the Sweden idiocy of 2 weeks ago, how do you respond to that? How do our allies, what a quaint word, how do our allies respond to that?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I think what they'll have two reactions. One is that it will really underscore their concern. They'll be really worried, basically, that they can't trust the president. They'll essentially, you know, think that if push comes to shove and there's a problem, you know, this guy doesn't understand them and is a wild card. And the other thing is they'll look for assurance from everyone else, just as we were talking about a second ago. The next day, all the other members of the cabinet will come out and say that's not what he really meant, and, you know, our alliance is strong. And so there'll be some sort of assurance there. But these episodes like Sweden or Australia or any one of a number of examples over the last, you know, month or so, right, you know, they point to the fact that the commander-in-chief is not exactly upholding sort of these alliances and commitments.
From your international relations purview, why is trade down? Why is world trade down, down, down?
Down over the last few years?
No, over the last 10 years, last 20 years.
Last 10 years.
The growth rate of trade is down. I mean, we're not gadding it like we used to gad it. Mm.
Yeah, I think it's, it will be important, and we say this in the report you mentioned, to look at free trade agreements and look at economic diplomacy and say, you know, it's not just about market access anymore. It's also about distortions in the market, whether it's Chinese use of state-owned enterprises or currency or many other issues, and then to work with like-minded countries to try to address those, you know, problems. So I think there are problems in, you know, the global economy. Trump is not sort of wrong about that, but it's really, you know, how he's responding and whether or not the appropriate way to respond is by launching a trade war or a general economic war with China or Mexico, which could be catastrophic and counterproductive, you know, or is it to work, you know, diplomatically and multilaterally with other sort of large industrialized democracies to try to address these issues. So I do think there's, it's not that the concerns about the trading system are unfounded. I think there is some reason for concern, but it's not in the sense that he's saying that the U.S. has lost out on these deals and it's just been negotiating badly, I think.
Thomas Wright, you have a book coming out, All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power, due to be published in May. And I can just picture you pouring over the galleys in early November and the election result. How much did you have to revise in light of this election, in light of what we're seeing with this new administration?
Yeah, it's a great question. The draft was done before November 8th, but I had they said that if Trump won, I'd have a chance to make some revisions. The book really is arguing that this age of sort of great power cooperation and convergence toward a liberal international order is over and unraveling, and that we're seeing the advent of a more nationalist and geopolitically competitive world. And so prior to the election, I thought the U.S. would be pushing back against that, you know, that the U.S. would be trying to stop that from happening and trying to uphold the liberal order. And I guess what I sort of corrected for was that actually the U.S. is more caught up in it than I might have, than I had anticipated. But the basic sort of gist of the argument, I think, was, in some ways, Trump just confirmed it, right? Because it just really underscored that this was this force was even stronger than I thought, and I thought it was sort of the driving force.
Dr. Wright, one more question, if we can squeeze it in here.
Yeah.
You have the luxury of experience in Dublin Cambridge and over at Georgetown as well. Is there a risk that the city and the financial part of London could move part or all to Dublin? Do you buy that idea?
Well, I think that, I mean, I think that they will definitely lose, the City of London will definitely be diminished. I think there's very little doubt about that. The folks I speak to over there when I go over to for events in the City of London very much acknowledge it up front. The question is the destination. I think it's not at all clear it will be Dublin, although Dublin is picking up some business.
Mm-hmm.
But Frankfurt and Amsterdam, I think, are strong competitors as well. But, you know, the folks in London hope that they will only lose business that is specific to, you know, the passporting issue, but it could be more broad than that.
We've got to leave it there. Tom Wright, thank you so much. Dr. Wright is with the Brookings Institution. What we're going to do here is investment talk, and we'll do the political talk in our next section with one of our most popular guests, one D. Harrow, David Harrow of Harris Associates and the Oakmark International Fund, joins us now. David, you have had immense repair to your track record, and this is typical with international, where you get a ginormous year, and then you get a bad year, and maybe you get two good years and two off-the-mark years. What's the year ahead or the two-year ahead view, David Harrow, on international stocks versus U.S. multinationals?
Well, good morning, Tom. And this view, for me anyway, is always predicated on where we sit in terms of the valuation spectrum, where stocks are trading in terms of, you know, the conventional valuation indices that I like to use, like cash flow yields, EV to EBITDA. I mean, just looking at how businesses are priced and given what business conditions are like. And what we see today is they're about average price. We don't see panic fire sales like we saw during certain periods in the last year or two. Recall in the beginning of 2016, we had a very, very weak start, bottomed in February, and then in international markets got really hit hard right after Brexit. And to me, these were really, really good panic buying, there was panic selling given a good buying opportunity. We don't see euphoria in the markets because there's still people scared of what might happen in Europe with the elections, and we always have this with the elections. But what we see is valuations are just about average. They're not super attractive, and they're not overpriced.
Right. Okay.
So it's really a stock picker's market.
The humble one forgets to mention that 32 days ago you were named Morningstar's International Stock Fund Manager of the Year. And the issue here, David Gura, it's like the Oscars. You just expect that Meryl Streep will come up on stage. Same thing with David Harrow. But David, to the boom bust of your world, and you've won every award there is within this, do you just assume last year was a great year, this year's a bad year?
No, not necessarily. What you do assume is that you can't look in the past, and you have to keep looking forward, and you have to keep the portfolio forward positioned. And, you know, if I look at my history at Harris Associates, it's almost 25 years. There's been about three or four big bust years and about 12 or 13 big boom years. And to me, that's livable, because what we're ultimately trying to deliver is performance over 3, 5, 10, 15 years, as opposed to just trying to match the index over week to week, month to month, quarter to quarter, half year to half year. And I think there is a trade-off. There is a trade-off between, you know, trying to achieve short-term performance and trying to achieve medium and long-term. And we'll take the medium and long-term any day. So if it means some short-term underperformance, I'll take that if it means we're going to get greater medium and long-term outperformance.
Let me ask you a bit about the Italian banking sector. We've talked about that a bunch here over these last few months. And let me just get a sense of where you see opportunity there. There were reports here of an Intesa Generali merger happening. And we've talked about the need, perhaps, for more consolidation in the banking sector in Italy and in Europe more generally. Where do you see things headed there?
Yeah, There definitely needs to be more consolidation in the Italian banking market, probably even in the German, the Landesbanken, which the setup there makes it very difficult for any bank to make money doing local banking in Germany. But back to Italy, yeah, we're big shareholders of Intesa. And we were watching this quite closely because this Generali, in our view, it made limited sense. And management assured us they're going to stick to the plan, they're going to stick to their capital allocation policies, et cetera, et cetera. And so we trusted them. We trusted them because they have a very good track record. The CEO of Intesa is very sound. They continue to perform. They're starting to grow their loan book. Loan losses are going down. Costs are going down. And they're distributing most of their excess capital, which they have a bit of. Intesa Sao Paulo actually has excessive capital, and they're distributing it, most of it, back to owners. So this is what we liked, and we were raised some doubts on this Generali, but they looked at it. They looked at it closely, and they decided to pull back, which to us was a good sign, unless you could really, really make a strong case for business combination, because these things are littered with the laws of unintended consequences when you merge two big entities. There's so much work that needs to be done in combining businesses, and you just have to make sure you're really paying the right price and you have the ability to integrate and to manage. So it's fraught with risk. So we're pretty happy that they backed away from that.
Jonathan Golub was here just a few minutes ago talking about how well you would have done if you'd gotten into American financials shortly before the election. Is there still room to get into financials here in the U.S. and indeed overseas?
Well, overseas in particular, there's been a little bounce. But if you just look at the valuation spreads, where they're trading at versus historic on an absolute basis versus other sectors, there's still a lot of room, especially since we're starting to finally see in Europe, finally starting to see lending growth, you know, 3%, 4%, 5%, 6%, and that's better than not. And in the meantime, these banks have been very proactive at cutting costs. The regulatory burdens seems to have been the strictest regulatory burdens that we saw in Basel III seem to kind of be in the rearview mirror. Most of these big European firms are at or above their desired capital positions.
Yeah.
So I think valuation is still saying, for at least for European banks like BNP and Tesla, Lloyd's, it's yes, you should be looking at these seriously.
How did you respond to the Kraft, Heinz, Buffett, private equity, tons of money going after Unilever? Did you own Unilever?
We don't own Unilever, but I've looked at it. We've owned it in the past. And, you know, this company does not have a good pedigree. I mean, recall it was an Anglo-Dutch monstrosity, two chairmen, two CEOs, two CFOs, two everything. And I don't even know if they've ever quite recovered from that. You know, these big companies with all these brands, they just sometimes lack focus. And they become huge bureaucracies. And, you know, to be honest, I think maybe, you know, the 3G and Heinz Kraft people would have had a good run at Unilever. I would guess there's a lot of fat to cut there. And they have some good brands and some good businesses, especially in health and personal care and ice cream. We all like ice cream. But you know, I'm surprised they backed away so quickly. Maybe they're reloading, or because I think there's opportunity there for someone.
When you look at the VIX hovering around 12 on the issue, where does David Harris stand on the issue of complacency? What do you make of the VIX being where it is and indeed where it's been here for these last few months?
Yeah, that's not something I give a lot of thought about, but just looking at how quiet things are and knowing that, you know, for every period of quiet, there's a period of disquiet, I would assume that, you know, it's not sustainable. But, you know, you never know. If you look at charts of the VIX, there's been periods of time where it's been low for quite some time. And I think, you know, the market's kind of in a good place because what they think is going to be better, more pro-capitalist policy coming down the road.
David, let's talk about the politics. You've been moderately active in Republican politics in Wisconsin. That was a state that the president took right now. How intrusive is the Washington debate, what we're going to observe tomorrow night, the present budget debate, and with that, any delay in the hopes of Republicans, how intrusive is that on our GDP and particularly on our investments?
I think market participants have grown used to this political discourse, for better or worse. And as a result, especially as a result of various events happening and the impacts of markets becoming less and less and less. And so you're going to continue to see more noise out of Washington. It is a constant flow. This isn't all too new, but it does seem to be amped up a little bit. All you had to do is watch last night's programming on the Oscars. And, I mean, people are just extremely excited about this whole Trump presidency, one direction or the next. But I think the markets have grown somewhat less responsive, I wouldn't say immune, but less responsive to all this noise and chatter. And I think that what really market participants need to do is listen to the policy and look for things that make it better for corporates to grow their profits and cash flow streams. You know, if that happens, they hire more workers. If that happens, they invest more. If that happens, you know, it leads to better business conditions and economic growth. As a bottom-up value investor, what we really want is for our companies to be able to, you know, grow their cash flow streams in a safe, sound environment. And I think that's what this whole rally has kind of been about, is the belief that the policies of the previous 8 years have been very anti-capitalist, very anti-free market. And I think the policies, even though there's a little hair surrounding them, I think there's an anticipation that the policies will be a lot more pro-growth, pro-free market capitalism.
Are you listening now more to those? I was chatting about this a little bit earlier today. Do you listen less to Donald Trump and more to, say, Steven Mnuchin, who's been on the job now for just over a week? Are you when you're trying to understand what this administration is trying to do? Is it more useful as an investor to listen to those heading the agencies and those beneath them?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question. Is, you know, where does the puck really stop? Because, you know, Trump, with all his roaring, he does listen to the people around him. And I think that was evidenced during the whole, remember the first executive order on the immigration restrictions? And you heard the story of Madison, whatever, said, well, what about the green card holders? And they very quickly got to Trump, and he wanted that clarified. So he does listen to people. And he does have very strong people around him. That was one of the things that surprised me. Mm-hmm. I thought someone with such a big ego would put a bunch of weaklings around him. In fact, he put some very, very strong, highly opinionated people. And so I think you have to really listen to both, and you have to see how they interact. And I think really what one has to do is look to see if Trump is listening, learning, and reacting
right to
his skilled advisors. And I think it would be a very good sign if he does, because he is new to this. Right. He is new to politics, and he has some very good people around him.
David Harrow, thank you so much. Congratulations, David Harrow, on your Morningstar acclaim. It goes on the Harrow mantle of the fireplace.
The capacious mantle. Crowded
fireplace mantle. In the West Wing is where it goes. David Harrow with Oak Martin Harris Associates, international manager of the year. But that's how it is, David. I mean, David Gura. I find that in international, you know, you wait, you go, it's not working, and then boom! You get 1 year or 2 years to. It's a different cadence than domestic.
Yeah, no, and I was again struck by what he had to say there about the European banks. We talk about European banks in terms of how they are structurally and in the context of financial regulation. But interesting to hear David Harrow there talk about opportunity in the European banking system right now.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.